Talk 1370, the right choice for weekends.
Where do babies come from?
Where do you think they come from?
Well, I think a stork, he drops it down, and then a hole goes in your body, and there's blood everywhere coming out of your head, and then you push your belly button, and then your butt falls off, and then you hold your butt, and you have to dig, and you find a little baby.
That's exactly right.
Previously.
The uterus is just a big muscle. I mean, you know, I tell my patients the uterus is kind of like a jelly donut. You have this big muscular wall.
I know you say that, and I always think that sounds so weird.
I know it does, but you know what? Patients can relate to jelly donuts, and they can't relate to uterus. You know, I mean, everybody's had a jelly donut. I mean, even you. I mean, I know you very well. You've had jelly donuts in your life.
Yeah, I have.
You don't want people to think that you have, but I know you have. But,
once or twice. So,
this is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hey, this is Dr. Natalie Berger from Texas Fertility Center. It is July 17th, and it's 12:05 p.m. We are talking to you live from Talk Radio 1370 a.m., and we're going to be discussing things a little bit further, sort of picking up where we left off last week about testing. Before we get into the midst of all the juicy stuff, just want to go over a few basic details here. It is a steamy Saturday, currently 91 degrees, and it's going to go up to the high 90s later, so hopefully you guys have access to air conditioning. And it is breaking news from our news desk here that there is quite a bit of traffic out there. So for those of you who are in your cars driving and listening to us, just be aware, I-35 southbound at Onion Creek, bad news. Palmer Lane southbound at McNeil Drive, also not a good place to be right now. Couple other bad spots in the area, Oltorf and I-35, as well as William Cannon and I-35. So you guys who are out there in your cars, again, you know, be safe and listen carefully as you are driving. We don't want you to get into another accident there. So I'm going to be joined here in a moment by my partner, Dr. Kalen Silverberg. He is currently coming to us from California, where he is enjoying, I'm sure, some better weather than we are. But in any case, we are going to be, you know, just talking about some basic testing stuff and sort of what it is that we do and why we do it and how we do it, when do we do it, who gets it done, all those basic details. At any point, if you guys have any questions, feel free to give us a call at 390-1370. Again, that's 390-1370. I'd be happy to take your call and, you know, talk about anything, whether it's related to what we're talking about today with testing, or if you have any kind of general questions about the evaluation itself or any kind of treatments or just any kind of fertility questions per se. So let's go ahead and get started. Now, testing sounds like it's going to be this horribly rigorous, awful thing, but it's really important for us to get as much basic information before we settle into what kind of treatments we're going to be offering. You know, we certainly don't want to rush into something and then realize that we've forgotten some very basic details there before, you know, spending a lot of time and resources on treatment. And, you know, in terms of who gets tested in our clinic, we know that it is pretty much everybody who comes to see us gets some form of testing done. It's very common for couples come in to get sort of a basic fertility evaluation, which includes testing things like the uterus, fallopian tubes, ovaries, and sperm. Occasionally, we'll have couples come in and everything looks fine, but it looks like she's not having periods at all. And sometimes certain couples will really strongly prefer to do sort of the minimum testing, which would really just be ultrasound testing for her and some blood work. But usually we're doing more sort of comprehensive testing just to make sure we don't leave out any kind of details there. So in terms of how we do it, well, there are basically some different components to the testing we do. Again, typically blood work, something called an X-ray dye test, sperm testing, and ultrasound examination with a physical examination. Though we do the examinations and ultrasounds in our office, we actually do send patients to a separate laboratory to get their blood work done. And the X-ray dye testing, which we'll talk a little bit more about, is done by a place called Austin Radiology, and they have very good facilities, and we have a very good relationship with them. And they really do an excellent job in terms of evaluating the uterus and fallopian tubes for us. And then sperm testing is done by Austin IVF, which is connected to Texas Fertility, but is not technically the same thing. Before I go further here, let's go ahead and see if I can get my partner on the line here.
Hey, Natalie, you there?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Boy, I mean, you're a terrific fertility doc, but boy, you've got a potential career in traffic and weather.
Yeah, no kidding.
Although it does sound like it's really hot there. It's hot here, too. It's about 90 here now.
And yeah, but your humidity
is... It's only about 10:15 in the morning. It's crazy.
Wow. But humidity-wise, you're probably doing a lot better than we are.
Yeah, I suspect so.
Yeah, I suspect so.
Well, we had talked, Lisa and I spoke last week about the HSG. We kind of started down that road. I don't know if you want to pick up there, kind of where we left off.
Sure. Yeah, in terms of the HSG, that, for you folks who don't know fertility language and such, stands for hysterosalpingogram. We also call it the, quote, X-ray dye test. And it is a really important test. Certainly, if you go on the internet and listen or read stories about people who've had this test done, you may be filled with fear before getting this test done. But it is something that is very critical in terms of looking at the fallopian tubes. And essentially, it's the only basic test that we have that tells us about the fallopian tubes. We know that on ultrasound, typically you cannot see the fallopian tubes unless they are usually damaged or so. So the X-ray test, or HSG, is really a fundamental part of our fertility testing. And I'm not sure what you tell your patients, Kaylin, but like I typically tell them, you know, before your HSG, maybe half an hour or 60 minutes beforehand, consider taking some Motrin, 400 or 600 milligrams beforehand, just to help with the cramping.
And the test really should be painless. The problem is that we don't know what we're going to find a lot of times until the X-ray's been done. And if, in fact, a woman's got an obstructed fallopian tube, she's got a blocked tube, as they try and push the dye through, that's going to cause some cramping and maybe even some spasm of the tube. And it really is not any worse than a menstrual period. Sometimes a pretty severe menstrual cramp. And so if you'll go ahead and you'll take some ibuprofen, just like you're saying, before the procedure, that really can block that because it really blocks a lot of cramping anyway.
Yeah. And it's true that typically the cramping is going to be worse during the procedure. So if you are starting to experience the cramping, you know, to be aware that in most cases it's going to significantly reduce in the few minutes to hour after the procedure. So it's not something that should persist for a long time in the vast majority of people.
Right. In fact, patients, if they go, you know, they can get their X-ray done and then they can go right back to work. So it's not like they need to go home. There's no anesthesia that's given for the procedure. And the overwhelming majority of patients really don't have any cramping from it. So, you know, you go in, it's a little inconvenient. The radiology technician will put a speculum inside the vagina. They then go ahead and then they guide a little tube or a little catheter into the cervical opening, and they start to push some dye while there's this big camera suspended from the ceiling that takes pictures. And so most patients, you know, during that five-minute procedure, most patients experience no cramping at all, and the radiologists get good pictures, and then they can send the pictures to us, and we can read them. The radiologists will read them as well. And then patients go ahead, they change clothes, and they go right back to work.
Right. So it's something that should not, you know, steal your day away from you. It, again, can be crampy, but it's a very necessary test, and it can give us valuable information. On top of that, there may be some therapeutic value as well, too. And do you tell your patients anything particular about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the point I was getting ready to make as well, is that not only does the HSG give us diagnostic information, it'll allow us to look at the uterine cavity. We can make sure there's nothing in the cavity like fibroids or polyps or scar tissue, or even just to make sure that the uterus was formed properly when the patient herself was developing in her mother's uterus. But it also evaluates the fallopian tubes. So we can tell if the tubes are open. We can tell if they're mobile. We can tell if they're open, not just where they come off the uterus, but also at the other end near the ovary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because it's important all over there, all over the entire course of the tube. But also, there's a lot of data that suggests that for anywhere from 2 to 3 months, some studies suggest from 3 to 6 months, pregnancy rates are higher. And right. There's a lot of potential reasons for this. Natalie, I mean, what do you talk to your patients about potential reasons for why the HSG may be have therapeutic benefit.
Well, I haven't really seen any great data on it, and certainly there's not going to be any big, expensive study looking at it because, you know, who's going to do that? But I talk about the possible, you know, flushing of the fallopian tubes with the dye. There may be something about that that helps with the patency of the fallopian tube or the openness of the fallopian tube. And in someone who may have a very subtle blockage that just needs a little bit of fluid to sort of push through the blockage, that may be all it takes in some individuals. So that's, you know, pretty much what I tell them. And
yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, you know, we know that when women shed that uterine lining once a month and they have a period, those cells don't all go forward. They don't all go through the cervix and into the vagina and out. Some of those cells go backward. And it doesn't take a very big clump of cells to block off the proximal fallopian tube. And so when they do that HSG, if that dislodges those cells, then you may very well just open the potentially blocked tube just by doing the X-ray itself.
Right. So, you know, the crux here is it's an important test, and it is something that can actually have some fertility value as well, too. So, yes, it's not the most comfortable thing in some situations. However, there can be a fertility boost in the few months following. And so to really remember that, especially if you are having some cramping during the test, that it can be both diagnostic as well as therapeutic.
For sure.
So,
for sure, it's been one of the most important tests that we do. I'd say that that and the semen analysis are probably the two most important tests we do because, you know, women can tell pretty much if they're ovulating. We can tell a lot of the times just by the history, although there's certainly some inexpensive tests we talked about before that they can go pick up at the grocery store just to confirm ovulation.
Gotcha. So what we're going to do is we're going to start segueing into the next topic, which is going to be blood work with our next segment. And again, this is Natalie Berger with Kaylin Silverberg. We're talking at beyondthebirdsandbees.com or beyondthebirdsandbees at talkradio.com. And we are going to be with you in a few minutes again talking about some more important fertility stuff. For any questions, you guys call 390-1370. Again, 390-1370.
And baby, your love is going to change me. And now I can see everything.
Talk 1370, the right choice. Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hey, this is Natalie Berger again with Kaylin Silverberg, two of the five doctors at Texas Fertility Center. We are talking today about fertility testing. Just wanted to clarify that our actual real website is txfertility.com. Beyondthebirdsandbees.com would have been cute, but we actually do have our official regular website of txfertility.com. And it's exciting because we actually have the ability now to translate our website into multiple different languages. So if you go to txfertility.com, you will find the ability to translate our entire website into Vietnamese, Spanish, Hindi, and now Chinese, which I can't even begin to imagine how that looks on the actual website. But no, it's very exciting. And it's certainly for those folks who have, I don't know, relatives or friends who are not native English speakers and who you're trying to relay information to, this would be actually an interesting way to convey that information to them. So actually going to our website, finding the segment that you're interested in, and then actually just hitting the Power Translator button into the language of your choice. And I'm wondering now if we have Kaylin back with us?
Yep, I'm here.
Great. All righty.
I'm here. Yeah, the website's really unbelievable, and this the translator function is just so cool. I've had a lot of patients take advantage of that already, and they're just so impressed. The problem is I don't want people to come to the office and think that we've got reams of people who can speak Vietnamese and who can speak Mandarin and who can speak Hindi. You know, we have maybe a couple who can do, you know, certainly Spanish we can cover, and Hindi we can cover, but I think Mandarin, we're going to be out of luck there.
Right, right. But
I also
luckily...
I do want to encourage patients to go see, and the couples in general, just to go check out our website, because our website is so cool now. It's www.txfertility.com. It's an authority website, so whereas most physician websites are, you know, 6 or 8 pages, ours is about 170 pages. It's really extensive. It's really comprehensive. Lots of links that can take you to other resources. we have so many patients who come see us from out of town, from out of Texas, from out of the country even, and we've got a great section in there for all of our out-of-town patients where they can do anything from make hotel reservations to dinner reservations to see different activities around Austin, things that are going on. There's just Austin's such a cool city, and there's so much that happens all the time. But the other thing is if patients want to call our office phone number is 451-0149. Again, that's 451-0149. So, Natalie, I think we're going to pick up again on some other testing.
And actually, before we get to that, speaking of calling, we have a caller calling in right now. Hi, caller.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Yes, I was hoping that you would take a question about the protein, the extra protein found in the blood work around 16 weeks.
You know, actually,
I think it's called MSAFP.
Yeah, and you are referring to, I believe, the quadruple marker screening, which
Correct.
Is typically done in the middle of pregnancy. Now, it's true that we actually see patients for fertility evaluation and then up until usually about 8 to 9 weeks. And then we actually refer patients back to their OBGYN.
Okay.
And so it's actually their OBGYN who will be performing that more detailed screening.
Okay. And that's not something that you can comment on? That you feel
it's
like you
true. We're not
on.
The experts, and I certainly wouldn't want to lead you in a different direction because truly the OBGYNs are the experts at the second third
okay.
trimester.
Okay.
We are.
Huh? Natalie, you may want to tell her that we are going to be having a couple of OB-GYNs on in the next few weeks. And so if she wants to call back at that point in time,
well,
I think they're, as you say, I think they're much more adept at being able to comment on that test.
MSAFP, but a completely normal sonogram, and I want to know when I can stop worrying.
Right. And that,
or if at all.
That definitely would be a great question for the OBGYN. So what I would say is when we are coming on the next few weeks or so, we have the OBGYNs on. That would be a great question for
okay.
them.
Okay. I will but call back.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we will talk about blood work at least earlier on. So blood work that we like to test, you know, before pregnancy or trying to, for someone who's having problems with fertility, what is important blood work to be doing. And in terms of the basic testing, a very sort of basic panel that typically our patients are getting done would involve some testing of their thyroid, prolactin, as well as ovarian function testing. And Kaylin, what do you sort of like to include in your blood work?
Well, it really depends on the individual circumstance. So, for example, if we have patients who are 35 years of age or older, we're usually going to ask them to go get their blood drawn on day 3, which is the third day of menstrual bleeding, the third day of their cycle. And it's been shown in lots of studies that the levels of FSH, which stands for follicle-stimulating hormone, and the levels of estrogen correlate with how many eggs there are left in the patient's ovaries. So we know that as women get older, the number of eggs that they have left diminishes. And after age 32 to 35, that number diminishes really pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that we evaluate a concept called ovarian reserve. And that tells us not only how many eggs the patients still have, but also what's the quality like. Because
right.
we know that quality and quantity, while not identical, are closely related. So, for example, if a patient comes in and she's over 35, we're going to check her blood on day 3. And if her FSH and estrogen levels are high, that means that her ovarian reserve is low, which mm-hmm. means that we don't have much time if we're going to make this procedure or make this process happen. If, on the other hand, her FSH levels are low and her estrogen level is low as well, that's a good prognostic sign. It means that the eggs that she has left probably are still functional. They may very well still be very good, and maybe we're not as pushed to be as aggressive at the beginning, which is terrific.
Right. And
if patients have go ahead. Do you have any other comments about those tests?
Well, in terms of the levels, because people ask sometimes, you know, what is a normal level for an FSH or the estrogen that we check, which is called estradiol?
Right.
So what do you tell your patients in terms of normal ranges?
Well, here's it's an easy question to ask, and it's a complicated question to answer. So, for example, the way I explain it to my patients, if I want to know what your blood count is, then it's real simple. We draw your blood, we pass it through a machine, and that blood count and that machine will tell me that you've got 8,300 white blood cells in every cc of blood. The problem is it's not as easy to check for hormone levels. So there's no machine that's going to count molecules of estrogen or molecules of FSH. And this is why when patients go on the Internet and they look to find out what the ideal level is for a day 3 FSH, there's a lot of different information
mm-hmm.
because it varies by laboratory. So what I tell my patients is I would love for your day 3 FSH level to be under 15, and in fact, I'd prefer for it to be under 12 if possible.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to your estrogen level, I really want it to be under 65, and I would prefer for it to be under 50.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that if your FSH is over 15, it's all over and you need to either think about donor eggs or adoption. And similarly, it doesn't mean that if your estrogen is over 65, you're in the same problem. But on the other hand, we do know, because, and the reason I say that is because we've all had pregnancies, good pregnancies, in patients who do have elevated FSH levels or do have elevated estrogen levels. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. Number one, even though ovarian reserve may be diminished, it doesn't mean that every egg that's still there is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, because there is so much variability in the hormone level testing, just because you have an FSH of, you know, 15 or 16, it doesn't mean that it's really 15 or 16. In fact, some studies suggest that hormone testing can be off by as much as 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So an FSH level of 15, for example, could really be 12.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's true that, you know, with the FSH level and the estradiol level, typically we ask patients if they're getting it done to do it on day 3. But doing it on day 2 or 4 of their menstrual cycle could also be just as fine as well, too. And that may be more convenient if their
Absolutely.
Third day happens to be a Sunday, for instance.
It gives them a broader window to try and hit. I mean, if we tell people, you know, you need to go in on day 3 to get your blood drawn, well, you know, what if I'm out of town? What if it's a weekend? And by the way, there are laboratories in Austin that fortunately are open on the weekend. So, for example, you can go to St. David's Hospital. One of the benefits of a hospital, they're open, you know, 24/7, 365. And so it's easy to get your blood drawn there.
Yes. And it's true that, you know, we have patients certainly who have elevated ovarian function hormones, meaning elevated FSH and or estradiol, and who say, well, you know, why don't I repeat these tests in a month or two, see if they come down? And your response to that is?
Well, those studies have unfortunately been done. And in fact, a buddy of our practice, a guy named Jim Toner, who's now in Atlanta, he published that study when he was in Virginia, and he looked at that. And what he did was he would draw blood on his patients on day 2 or day 3 in consecutive months, and he would wait for the month in which their levels were down to normal. So he had a group of patients who had diminished ovarian reserve. Their FSHs were above 15, and he would wait. And all of a sudden, when he would find a month in which their FSH levels had come down, he would very aggressively treat them with hormones and very aggressively try and stimulate their ovaries to make eggs. And it was a great concept. The problem is it didn't work. And he found in his big study that waiting for that ideal month in which your hormone levels come down doesn't do any good because you don't respond any better. And
right.
So what that suggests to us is that once your FSH and estrogen levels are elevated, even if they're, you know, if they vary from month to month, it just doesn't matter. I mean, once they go bad, they're bad.
Right. And in terms of other things, a lot of times we will also check for patients something called a TSH or thyroid-stimulating hormone test as well as a prolactin hormone test. And this does vary from patient to patient, scenario to scenario, but it's not uncommon for a patient to have those four tests done, the FSH, estradiol, TSH, and prolactin. And then depending upon, like you were saying, like if someone has a condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome, we may consider checking some male hormones, as well as some glucose testing to see if they are pre-diabetic, even considering some cholesterol screening as well, too, because these individuals have some other longer-term risks and such.
Right, and this evaluation is really designed to help us make a diagnosis because, you know, fertility treatment, like most things in medicine, it's not like there's just one treatment that we apply to everybody. We individualize everything for everybody who we see. And so, for example, some women who come in with ovulatory dysfunction have a significant amount of increased hair growth. Well, we're going to make sure that there are no other causes for that. For example, sometimes you could have a pituitary tumor that can cause that. Sometimes you could have a tumor of the adrenal or even the ovary that can cause that. And so what they don't need is just a pill to make them ovulate regularly. They need to have that problem addressed immediately. Some women, for example, may come in with ovulatory dysfunction. In other words, they don't have regular cycles. And the problem may be that on physical exam, we find that they've got a breast discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And patients are always perplexed by that because they'll say, well, now, wait a minute. What does a breast discharge have to do with me having irregular cycles? And the answer is it's not the discharge itself that's the problem. It's the hormone elevation that leads to that breast discharge
mm-hmm.
because the same hormone that causes milk production from the breast can interfere with the normal cyclicity, the normal cyclic mechanism of hormone production in the pituitary gland that leads to normal egg development and ovulation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just amazing how all of these things can be so interrelated, and things that seem totally separate are actually part of the same process.
Right. And so it's true that we have sort of a common, you know, panel of things to look at, but certainly it's individualized per patient, per scenario in terms of what we actually do check. So
right.
It is not something that we have the same blood evaluation for every single patient, for sure.
Do you check TSHs on most of your patients, or do you not?
I do. I feel like, you know, thyroid disease is not an uncommon disease. It's an easy screening test, and I believe the American Thyroid Association recommends routine screening for people over the age of 30. They're, of course, going to be the most conservative in terms of screening, but I feel it's not unreasonable to look at the thyroid. So I, in general, do check it on most, if not all, patients.
Sure, and the popular literature is just full of information about thyroid disease because, you know, there's so many misconceptions about thyroid disease. I mean, a lot of patients will come in and they'll say, well, you know what, I've been gaining weight, therefore my thyroid must not be working right.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, my hair is falling out, I'm sure it's my thyroid. Or my skin's kind of dry, or I'm a little too hot or a little too cold, and so therefore my thyroid must be out of whack. And it's funny because, again, there's just so many things that can interplay and work off of each other. It's not always just one simple, easy diagnosis.
Right. And in terms of blood work, you know, another thing that we are also looking at when we are checking for fertility stuff is actually considering the concept of genetic screening as well, too. We know there are certain ethnic groups that are going to be more at risk for certain genetic diseases, things that you could actually be a silent carrier for, as well as your partner could be a silent carrier for. But if you're both carriers, you could have a chance of having a child that's affected. And
exactly right.
The American College of OBGYN does have certain recommendations for certain ethnic groups, including Caucasians, African Americans, Asian population, French Canadians, Cajun, Ashkenazi Jewish. But it's interesting because we actually have this new test that we are working with called Counsel that really allows us to do sort of a broad screening for some of these carrier or these rare diseases to see if someone may be a silent carrier again. And it's a very exciting concept because it really gives us the opportunity to really screen for over 100 different autosomal recessive or sort of silently carried genetic diseases.
Right. I mean, it's an amazing test. And, you know, until a couple of years ago, if we wanted to screen patients for certain types of diseases, for example, just sickle cell, you know, a very common disease, or cystic fibrosis. I mean, it's a very, you know, one in 25 people in the United States now are carriers for one of the different CF abnormalities.
Right.
And cystic fibrosis can just be a devastating problem. It can be a devastating disease to have, just like sickle cell can be, for example. But until recently, if we wanted to screen our patients, it was very expensive. They had to go in for blood testing. It would take a long time potentially to get the results back. And now this company in California has combined a lot of genetic findings that came out of the Human Genome Project with chip technology. And certainly people in Austin, you know, we've got such a high-tech community, people can relate to chip technology. But what they can do is they can actually use a saliva test. So you actually can just essentially spit into a test tube, as disgusting as that sounds. But you
right,
can spit into a test tube, and we send the test tubes off, and they can screen you for over 109 different genetic diseases, and it's less than $350 a pop. I mean, it's just for comprehensive testing. I mean, it's just
really
incredible.
Exciting. Yeah, and that testing can be, again, salivary, so you don't need to have blood work done for that. But that's very exciting, and what we're going to do now, we are actually going to transition on to our next segment in a few moments. But for those of you out there, again, who have any questions, feel free to give us a call at 390-1370. Again, it's 390-1370. And we're going to be talking in our last segment about ultrasound testing, as well as some of the testing that we don't recommend.
Once I had myself a good woman.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Natalie Berger again with Kaylin Silberg from Texas Fertility Center in Austin. We are talking some further today about testing, and before we get more into the nitty and gritty of that, just want to give you guys who've been following popular culture and such some information. This week in July birthdays, Jessica Simpson hits the big 30. What I find even more sort of wild, Knight Rider, Mr. Baywatch, David Hasselhoff, 57, and my favorite, Harrison Ford is getting close to 70. He is 68 this week, and he looks darn good for his age. But in any case, back to the serious stuff. We are going to be talking about more of the testing that we do typically for couples who come to see us for fertility evaluation. First, we'll start off with ultrasound and why we do it, sort of how is it done, what do we find out from it. And then at the very end, we're going to try to talk about some of the tests we really don't recommend, because there are definitely a number out there that people have a lot of misconceptions about. And depending upon the information you've gathered from friends, internet, books, you know, here and there, there are certainly some tests that we would not recommend adding to the basic evaluation. And let me first go ahead and find out if my partner's there, Kaylin.
Yep. Hey, Natalie, I'm here.
All right. So with ultrasound, you know, we do like to do an ultrasound of the woman, specifically looking at her ovaries and her uterus. And
correct.
You really, you know, we understanding that the X-ray dye test gives us some information about the uterus, it really doesn't give us the full picture. And so we do rely upon the ultrasound to look at the uterus further. And the X-ray dye test tells us nothing about the ovaries. So we're clearly focusing on that as well, too, to give us more information about their sort of anatomic perspective, how big they are and such. And people ask, because they come to see us and they, you know, we say, oh, we're going to do an ultrasound. And they're like, okay, cool. So we're going to go ahead and do the belly ultrasound. We're like, well, actually, we're going to do the internal ultrasound. And I realize that folks who haven't had an internal or a vaginal ultrasound before, sometimes their eyebrows go up. And there really is an important reason why we choose to do an internal ultrasound versus a transabdominal ultrasound. We know that the picture that we get, the resolution, the information is of much better quality than we can currently get with a belly ultrasound. And so it is true that, you know, even though it's a little bit more involved than a belly ultrasound, it really tends to be less certainly uncomfortable than even a pap smear or anything. And it's actually interesting for folks to look at as well, too, as we're doing it, because it's one of those things that we can actually show them about their pelvic anatomy. So I think a lot of folks actually get into it in terms of looking at their ovaries and their uterus and are really sort of fascinated by what we're able to see. And like, what kind of things do you look at specifically at the uterus when you do the ultrasounds?
Well, I really want to know how big the uterus is. So I want to make sure that it's not enlarged, because if it's enlarged, you think about a couple of different conditions. The main one is fibroids, uterine fibroids. Mm-hmm. And fibroid tumors, as you know, are very, very common. In fact, it's the most common benign tumor in the pelvis in women. So by age 35, we know that 25% of Caucasian women, 40% of Hispanic women, and 50% of African-American women will have clinically significant fibroids. And I don't mean by clinically significant, I don't mean fibroids that we find with ultrasound. I mean fibroids that are causing them symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So pain with their period, or heavier bleeding, or irregular bleeding, things like that, or enlarging uterus, or as the uterus gets bigger, it can push on the bladder, and they can, you know, need to urinate more frequently. As it gets bigger, you know, towards the backside, it can push on the rectum, and they may have problems with constipation. So these are clinically significant fibroids. They can also interfere with intercourse. So that's one thing we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to look at the uterine lining, because if we look mid-cycle, the uterine lining gets to be nice and thick. And as it gets to be nice and thick, you can see things in the uterine cavity, like a polyp, or, for example, a fibroid tumor that may be in the cavity. Or, for example, if the uterus didn't form correctly, you may be able to see some problems with the shape of the cavity itself.
Mm-hmm.
You look for anything else?
Yeah, it actually is interesting. I had I've had a patient in the past who her X-ray dye test was read as normal, but clearly there was something unusual about her ultrasound. There was a very bright area in it. And it really reminds us that, you know, the X-ray dye test is not even by itself perfect at looking at the space inside the uterus where a pregnancy would grow. It actually ended up being that this person likely had some retained pregnancy tissue and actually had a piece of bone actually inside the uterus. And
wow.
That was, you know, it was a very dramatic ultrasound picture, though the X-ray dye test was, again, felt to be normal per the radiologist. So it really, again, highlights the fact that both these tests together can give us a lot of information before even going to the step of looking surgically or such. And then also, you know, with the uterine muscle, you can also get a suggestion, though this is not an absolute diagnosis, of something called adenomyosis, which is sort of a cousin to fibroids. It typically, on ultrasound, will cause some thickening of one side of the uterus or the other and may cause some different pattern of the uterus on the ultrasound. That's something we can get a sense of as well, too, with the muscle of the uterus.
Right.
And also the position. Like if someone's uterus is way off to the right or left, that makes my ears perk up basically about the possibility of scar tissue or adhesions inside the pelvis. Not always. And we certainly have had patients who, you know, you have a concern about it. You actually look with a procedure called laparoscopy and realize they just may have a variation of normal where their uterus just tilts to the left or the right. An important comment, which we've talked about also before about the tilting, it is normal for the uterus to tilt forward or backward and sometimes to even be more sort of straight up and down. But for folks who've been told their uterus is, quote, tilted, that's not unusual. It has no impact on fertility. And so for those folks who are concerned about that being a issue, worry no more.
Correct.
And the other thing that we, you know, classically look at are the ovaries in ultrasound. And in terms of the ovaries, the right and left ovaries, we're sort of looking for their overall general location because we know that typically they're sort of on the sides of the uterus. And if we find one or both behind the uterus or in some other area, it also makes us question the idea of scar tissue, or in some cases, people who had ovaries who never developed properly, never came down to their proper location on the sides of the uterus. And so that's something that I look at in addition to how the ovary looks. What size is the ovary? Are there any cysts on the ovary? Some cysts are actually normal during the menstrual cycle, and other cysts are not supposed to be there. And, you know, very classically, cysts like that would be endometriomas, which are a form of advanced endometriosis or dermoid cysts, which for people who are interested, these are one of the most fascinating things in OBGYN, where you actually can get cysts on the ovaries that can contain, get this, hair, teeth, and other bony things as well, too. So very interesting cysts, but these cysts do not belong there versus other kinds of cysts that we know are normal to have during the menstrual cycle, depending upon where you are. And also, you know, realizing we've been talking about the way that the uterus sort of looks like a jelly roll. I think that was something you had mentioned last week. We talk also about the ovary sort of looking like chocolate chip cookies, with the ovary itself, the cookie part. And what you're liking to see is a lot of little dark spots on the ovaries, which are indicating the little follicles and that overall represent a small percentage of the overall number of eggs in the ovaries. So we like to see ovaries that have lots of chocolate chips on them. And this gives us a good sense that their ovaries are acting young. In a person, looking at their ovaries with the ultrasound, doing some blood work, possibly, and taking into account their age can give you a pretty good sense as to what their ovarian function is overall. And do you do anything else sort of ultrasound-wise?
Well, I mean, you know, the only other things we're looking for are things that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, we tell patients all the time, you shouldn't be able to see your fallopian tubes with ultrasound. But on the other hand, if we see kind of a big cystic structure, a dark structure around the ovary that looks kind of like a tube, you know, kind of a cylinder, we know that that's probably going to be an abnormal fallopian tube. And you know, again, if you can see fallopian tubes with ultrasound, they're not normal. You shouldn't be able to see them.
Right.
And so there are other things that we shouldn't be able to see. I mean, there are other, you know, any other mass that's in the pelvis. Sometimes you'll find a kidney that shouldn't be in the pelvis. It should be up in the abdomen. But basically, you know, for fertility purposes, what we're looking at really are the ovaries and the uterus.
Right. And in the last few minutes... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry.
We have a few minutes left, and I sort of wanted to touch base briefly on the testing that we don't recommend, because this is actually really important for folks to understand why it is that we don't recommend certain tests that they find on the internet and such. And, Kaylin, do you want to talk more about those?
Yeah, there are really three basic tests that we don't do. I mean, the one test that we don't do is a post-coital test, which
thank
we'll talk
goodness.
About. The next one is the endometrial biopsy, which we really don't do anymore. And then the third one are just these kind of fertility panels of blood tests that, you know, things like natural killer cells and all kinds of unusual panels of tests that have been described on some internet sites. And we just believe that they're a waste of time and that the big studies that have looked at them show that they really don't correlate with anything. And unfortunately, I think a lot of patients have been taken for a financial ride by reading some of these internet sites and subscribing to some of these theories and getting their blood drawn, then they ship it off to either California or Chicago or Indianapolis, and they get their blood drawn, and they just get these tests drawn that are just really kind of wacky, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. And it's especially tempting in a scenario where you have unexplained infertility, which happens in about 20% of our patients, to look at these exotic tests for some sort of answer. Because if our conventional testing has failed to reveal a definite answer, it's so much human nature and tempting to look at these things and say, oh, there must be something about these other tests that we must be missing. And unfortunately, the research, like you're saying, doesn't support the fact that these more exotic, especially blood tests and such, have an influence on what we can really determine is the issue or give us any kind of good treatment to treat people with.
Fortunately, our OB-GYN partners in Austin really keep up with literature, and they understand that these tests are kind of crazy, and so we don't have any problems really with patients coming in from their OB-GYN saying, oh, my doctor or so-and-so said that I should get this test drawn and send my blood off to be evaluated for all these crazy natural killer cells and all these other things. But how about just the common stuff, Natalie? What about the postcoital test?
Right, and that's a test where basically it's an old-fashioned test, and believe it or not, when I was in medical school, we were still doing it. And that wasn't that long ago. But anyways, it's a test where actually the couple would have intercourse, and the woman would come in after intercourse, and then there would be a small sample of fluid taken from her vagina and her cervical area, basically, to see the number of moving sperm and to see if her her secretions were hostile to the sperm, and really the big studies that were done didn't really show any difference in terms of success rates, whether people had poor or good post-coital tests, not to mention that it's sort of an embarrassing and it's inconvenient and uncomfortable test. And so it's something that we actually don't offer because there's not really any validity to it. And not to mention it's really inconvenient and sort of not so much invasive, but yeah, it's a worthless test basically. And the biopsy as well, too. I mean, endometrial biopsies or uterine biopsies have their place, certainly, especially in cases where people have unusual bleeding or a thickened lining of the uterus for unknown reasons. But simply for fertility reasons, there's not an indication to do a endometrial biopsy, which is good because it's not the most comfortable test. It can definitely cause a lot of cramping. And so it's something that in occasions we will do, but we would certainly not recommend for the vast majority of people who are experiencing fertility issues.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. It's just, you know, I think that there's still a few people out there who are doing these kind of testing. And again, we try and do everything from a data-driven perspective. So we want to do what works. We don't want to do what doesn't work. We certainly don't want to charge people for things that are of no value. We certainly don't want to do testing that causes discomfort. And as you're saying, with the endometrial biopsy, in fact, it's normal for normal women to occasionally have an abnormal biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, the recommendation was made in our literature that if you really want to find out if somebody's got a short luteal phase or a luteal phase defect, you really should do biopsies in two consecutive cycles. Well, I mean, as I tell my patients, I mean, the line of people who want one biopsy of their uterus is really pretty short.
Right.
And the line of people who want two biopsies in consecutive months is even shorter. I mean, it's just, especially when we can just count. So what we'll do instead is we'll ask patients to use an ovulation prediction kit, which is cheap and it's painless. And then we want them to count the number of days from that LH surge until their next period starts. Because we know that as long as it's at least 13 days from the time of the surge until the next period, by definition, they can't have a short luteal phase and they mm-hmm. don't need to be treated.
Right. So all important stuff. And basically, like you're saying, you know, we do individualize the evaluation, though there are sort of some basic things there. But certainly for each scenario and each individual, we will do the testing that's appropriate and that's evidence-based and really is going to give us the most information and yet not be unusually expensive, invasive, and whatnot.
Right.
So we're going to be wrapping up today, and next time we will try to talk a little bit more about laparoscopy and hysteroscopy, which are some surgical, actually outpatient things that we can do to look a little bit further at fertility issues. And again, this is Natalie Berger. I've been talking with Kaylin Silverberg. We are physicians at Texas Fertility. Feel free to catch our website, www.txfertility.com, where we have multiple language abilities. And we will be seeing each other next week.